This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Hello, Kate Mildenhall.
Hello, Catherine Collette. How are you?
Yeah, good. I think I am at the point of the term when I'm waiting for the holidays to start.
Oh my gosh. And this is a short term, but it also feels endless already.
It feels endless and cold.
Yep.
Yeah, I think we've got 3 weeks. Is that right?
Yeah, 3 weeks. I know, because at the end of the 3 weeks, I'm going on my enormous 30-person trip to Bali. Stay tuned.
Are you going to buy a, is it Bitang Beer singlet?
I believe there is talk of having matching ones, but I will not be putting that one on, no.
Just even for the plane ride home.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, exactly.
Today's conversation is another awkward topic. It's something that's been on our list from the start. We're going to talk about endorsements, also known as blurbing or puffing. Particularly awkward time for you to be talking about this, isn't it, Kate?
I mean, I think it's always awkward when we talk about anything, but yes, it is particularly timely and particularly awkward because, of course, I have just gone through the process of asking for endorsements for the new novel, receiving wonderful endorsements for the new novel, being in the awkward space of, you know, not knowing or knowing how to ask, who to ask, dealing with the publisher on which ones go on the front, which ones go on the back, which ones go on the inside.
Are you involved in that process?
A little bit.
Do they just suggest?
Yeah, I was like, you do that. You know, which of these ones will work in what place. A couple of them I was like, oh no, can we use that phrase and not that phrase? But yeah.
It's, and did they go with your preferred phrase?
They did go with my preferred phrase. But yeah, so I'm kind of, and then so I've been asking people about this, you know, behind the scenes. And as I was getting in some of the responses, from authors, some of whom were authors that I asked for endorsements, I kind of became more and more awkward and aware of the enormous ask it is for people in terms of time and labor. So there's so many responses. I'm so excited to get into this, but I also know we're not going to be able to cover it all off because I got such great responses to this.
So I should just to clarify, you have been asking other authors for endorsements for your book, but you also put a call out on Instagram to ask about the endorsement process and what people think. You asked some very, that was the question, but you got some really interesting responses, and that is kind of the topic that we're going to talk about today.
That is. So I did it in two ways, very unscientific kind of process. This would not pass ethics if it was a PhD. I basically reached out kind of privately to past guests and friends and mates, you know, a variety between kind of newer authors and very established authors, and asked them a few questions about the endorsement process. And whether or not they would like to be quoted or anonymous. So people have come back on in those two camps. And then I also put a separate kind of call out on Instagram, and then we put it on the podcast as well, saying to people more as readers, you know, where do you get your book recommendations from? Do you pay attention to praise? And there were some interesting responses for that as well. So I won't talk about all of them. You can see the responses on my Instagram. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. But variety of responses for people. Some things they all agree on, some things they don't, but we shall go through them and see what we find.
And I guess as a little bit of kind of background context, it is something that we have touched on a little bit more briefly before on the podcast. There's a particular article I think you read.
Yes.
That sort of kickstarted some discussion initially.
Yeah, it did. And so the article is Fool's Gold. It's in SRB. It's by Catriona Menzies-Pike. It's very good. We talked about it when I first read it. And then interestingly, I was chatting to Kate Kennedy about this idea of endorsements, and she sent me the article again and said, have you read this? And so I read it again, and her kind of response was, I agree with everything that is said in this article. So to give context, the Fool's Gold article is a review of the book called Blurb Your Enthusiasm, An A to Z of Literary Persuasion by Louise Wilder, who's a US copywriter and professional blurber. Like that, she does marketing copy and blurbs books in the US. So it's kind of about her experience of that. But the
weird job. Is that a weird job? So she just does puff quotes for books?
Yes. Yeah, that is
written
that is
from her own perspective.
Yeah, I'm not entirely clear. I have not read the book, but she has been doing it a long time. She talks about her own experiences, but also, you know, the experience of the blurb in general and the history of it and things like that. So in the US context, blurbing is what we call endorsing or praising. It's also got Menzies Pike's kind of personal ideas in there about both the Australian context and the criticism or, you know, review culture criticism and what she calls this kind of hyperbolic kind of praising all the time and enthusiasm.
Is an incredible critic. She did that review of Trent Dalton's work, which I think I read about four times. We'll link to that in show notes if you missed out. It's just such a interesting, unique, clever, thoughtful review.
Yeah, extraordinary brain. I think that she is the outgoing editor. I think that she has just hand it over to someone else, but someone will correct us on that. So she says, and this is kind of the concept of the article, and I quote, in the blurb saturated present, authors can decry blurbs as corrupt and silly all they like. When they publish new books, however, they will be conscripted to marketing duties, obliged to solicit blurbs, and most will provide glowing snippets to hype their friends and colleagues too. And this is kind of this position that I think I find myself in at the moment. Like I am frustrated by the, you know, what I've sometimes called the endorsement machine and how much time we're asking of people. And yet, on the other hand, I have just done the same thing myself and asked people for it. So, you know, that's the kind of fraught position in the middle. Menzies Pike, like most, I think, all really of the authors I spoke to, and the general consensus in the industry today is cynical of blurbs, doesn't really pay attention to them, is frustrated by this kind of culture of total hype, like this is the best book of the year, et cetera, all that stuff, and unsure of how much the praise of other writers really does sell books. And there isn't hard data on this. So there's no way that you can test whether that person's praise, you know, sold the book. She does say, as Louise Wilder does, that it's a convention of book marketing that a word or two of recommendation from a big name will make a buyer look twice. And also goes into this idea of that authors' reasons to blurb vary, and it might be to build their own relationship with readers or with the author they're blurbing, or to boost the fortunes of a deserving peer, she says, or even, and most of the authors I spoke to said this, out of sincere admiration, like just straight up, I loved this book, or almost people who volunteer blurbs in advance. There was this other really interesting idea in there too, which I didn't talk about last time we talked about the article. And Menzies Pike refers to this 2018 essay by Michael Maguire, where he uses the phrase symbolic capital. And this idea that, you know, as authors, we build up this amount of kind of capital, social, cultural capital, and that we can use that in different ways to help other authors, et cetera. She finishes it kind of by saying, should blurbs be banned? Of course not. Must we launch a campaign for honest, sober language in book sales? That horse has bolted. Publishers are entitled to do what they think necessary to sell their books. And I think that's important too. We're all in the same industry. We need to sell books. So, you know, to look at it from different, perspectives. But so that's the kind of framework of the article. We'll put the link in the show notes. I do encourage people to have a look at it. She also talks about both the idea of advanced praise, which is when, you know, you've got those endorsers who have their name on your book when it comes out, and then this idea of what happens on social media afterwards and how you recommend. So we'll talk about that a little bit as well. But Catherine, I'm going to ask you first, as a reader, do you pay attention to endorsements? And if so, which ones?
Not really. No, definitely not the ones on a cover of a book. I wouldn't pay any attention to. I don't think I did pre-writing or being a published author myself. I do even less now because I think it's a demonstration of who you know.
Yes.
Be my take.
As a writer, what's been your experience for asking for endorsements, for giving endorsements? What's that experience for you?
As a writer, so I thought initially that I had never asked for an endorsement, but that's not true because when I was in the UK, I met up with my UK publisher. This was before the Helpline was published over there. I think I mentioned that I had interviewed Graham Simpson relatively close to that time. So they said, could you contact Graham and ask for a puff quote? And I said, yes. Then I contacted Graham. It is a massively awkward and hard thing to do. But
how did you
I remember
do it?
Just sitting on it for ages. I just emailed and sort of said straight up. So he came back and said, no, can't do it, too busy. So I sent that off to the UK. He subsequently came back. He said, look, I found time to read it, and then had put like a little bit of, like a few sentences together in the email and said, look, if there's anything in here you can use, you're welcome to use it. So I probably didn't think there was anything you could use in that, in the few sentences that he'd written, but I sent it to the UK. They put together, they kind of cut it up. It is on the UK version. It says, nicely observed. I think we all know someone like Jermaine. So, you know, I asked if your publisher, when you had feedback around an alternate sentence, I think I had suggested maybe you could use, there was a line where he had said something like deft writing, which nice. I thought was a bit more exciting than nicely observed.
Yeah.
They didn't want to do that. So that was my one experience of asking someone for a puff. I don't get asked for them very often at all. It's not a big thing for me. I have given them, I don't know, it's. I think I look to other things as a way of picking books, and puffs are not really much a part of it.
Interesting. That Graham Simpson one, that's that kind of idea of the big name. It doesn't really matter what Graham Simpson says.
No.
Because what that quote is showing also is that he has read the book. You know, it's specific.
Yes.
Because it shows that he knows the character.
And I guess as a writer, you want commentary on your writing, but as the bookseller publisher, they seem to want something more that talks to the characters in the book and the story itself. I was thinking about what actually turns me onto a book, and I think it's interviews with authors. Easy to say because I'm, you know, we're recording this on a podcast. But there are certain endorsements like Reese's Book Club. We don't really have an Australian equivalent for that.
Yeah.
But I do, if a book that I'm sitting on the fence about has a Reese's Book Club tag, I kind of think it's a type of book that is going to be pretty palatable, pretty easy to read.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think the UK context is interesting too for what they want from an Australian author. So I know that for The Mother Fault in the UK, they have a Jane Harper quote on the cover of The Mother Fault, and she read it voluntarily. I think we were doing an event together. I was interviewing her about her book. And so she read The Mother Fault and emailed me, you know, with her response to it and praise, and said that I could use those words. So they picked that up because The Mother Fault came out later in the UK. And in fact, the B format now of The Mother Fault, which is coming out this year ahead of the new book, that's all they've got. They've just got Jane Harper on. Oh, they've got Jane Harper on the front and some of the other ones on the back, which we got at the start.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess the other thing to take up Katrina Menzies-Pike point about puff quotes and endorsements versus this social media strand of promoting other people's books or saying how much you love them. I always feel this tension about posting about books on Instagram. For me, I do read a lot of Australian authors and books by local authors. So I think I should just spend the extra hour putting together a very nice, which you do a lot of, put a lot of time and energy into this. But even that is a lot of Like, it is a lot of time. And the other thing about it, even though it's a gift to other people, there's this performative element.
Yeah.
That, I don't know, it just sits funnily with me. Yeah, I don't know. Do you see the performance of writers? Is it interesting content? A is maybe one question, but yeah, this element of, there's a degree of self-promotion in the idea of, this is not a critique of you. This is an internal discussion within my own head. Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think a couple of the people that I spoke to talked about this idea that it is, when you endorse someone's book, it's about whether that book fits with your own readership as well. So people made comment on that it's a kind of a works both ways kind of a thing. I don't know. I think that what came up when I asked on Instagram about, okay, well, are you, when I recommend books, is that working? Are you buying them? Are you borrowing them? Are you picking them up? And who else do you take recommendations from? And from the people, you know, whatever, as I said, unscientific, 50 people responded or whatever. Some of them readers, librarians, some
librarians, authors. I love a recommendation from.
Yeah.
Librarians.
Yeah. Well, this librarian was saying that they take a lot of their recommendations from Bookstagram, from people they trust on Instagram. Lots of people were saying, yeah, that's where I find my books. If I trust the person who is putting them on. And I think that's kind of my internal criteria. Like, I do not put every book that I read on Instagram. Sometimes that's because I don't have time and I've forgotten them and I've got like a list of books that I still have to post about and say something about. But I do also think that
is about being a good literary citizen, though, isn't it? Which is as distinct from maybe when sometimes I'm reading other people's Instagram, I divide them into two categories. Is this awful? One is like this just, it is a post to support other writers, which is a very valid and important thing.
Yeah.
But then I don't know if it's necessarily recommending the book. God, I sound awful.
No, you don't sound awful at all. One of the people who responded, my dear friend Penny Russin, writer and teacher, she said, I can tell when a recommendation is genuine or when it's bullshit. And lots of people said that, you know, their kind of feedback was, I can tell when someone is supporting a book and I can tell when someone is recommending a book. Yeah. And I think there's a difference there.
We should say supporting a book rather than bullshit.
Yeah. Because one of the questions we asked or that I asked people was, how many times do they get asked to endorse books a year? And I reckon now I probably get, you know, between 20 and 30 requests. Some of them come direct from publishers. Always very nice, always mostly personalized. We think that you would like this book because et cetera, et cetera. I say no to most of those now just because of the time. But my general approach now is to say, you're welcome to send it. If I get time to read it, and then I will post about it. And if I like it, I will post about it. And often now the way that I end up putting praise on books is that a publisher will then say, can we use what you said on Instagram? And so that's another way.
That's really nice.
And other writers talked about in terms of the people I spoke to, two very established Australian writers who prefer to remain anonymous, said that is one way they prefer to do it now. They basically blanket say no, but that when they volunteer praise, whether it be on social media or in other forms, that publishers are welcome to use that praise. Kate Kennedy made a really great point when we were talking, and she said it's approximately 8 hours of work, depending on how fast you read, to read a book, to work out what you're going to say in a way that is both authentic and that you know, because we are in the industry of making words work, that you know the publisher is going to want, that you know there's a little clip out of that they can fit in a different way. And certainly the way that people responded to me was, you know, who have endorsed books before, was here is, you know, a little personal note to me about what they liked about the book, and then please use the sentences below as you or your publisher see fit. or let me know if you need me to change something. And that's normally how I do it when I respond to people. I'm like, here's the following sentences, use or edit as you see fit.
A good puff, kind of rare in some ways, like a fun puff. One of the ones that I've read recently, Nick Basine's book, I Look Forward to Hearing From You, which I think comes out in July. He has a puff that says, I wish I could write like Nick Basine, but reading his writing is the next best thing.
Yeah, nice.
Nice. Cute. Yeah.
That's really nice. One of the things I wanted to mention is that I did look to see if there were guidelines from the ASA on endorsements, giving them, asking for them. And I couldn't find anything on the website. And I didn't have time to contact the ASA, but that's maybe something that I will do, or maybe something that would be useful for the industry so that people are kind of aware. Because once I did that, those sums, and I went, oh my gosh, I've just got like 12 endorsements. That's 12 times 8 hours labor. That is a big request. It's something that, I mean, this is why we're having the conversation, just so that we're all aware that there's transparency around what this endorsement machine kind of looks like from all aspects.
Minor question for you. Do you read many books in manuscript form, or is it?
Yes, yeah, sometimes. Like sometimes, asking for advance praise, it's really hard to do. That's a big ask for people, I think, because it's just physically harder to do. But if it's a person that I want to support in advance, then, yeah, I'll say yes to that.
Yeah, interesting. And so in the responses that people had to you putting a call out for input, did people have any different or kind of unusual criteria for why they might say yes or why they might say no?
Yeah, this is interesting. So the leading question I asked was how many times a year do they get asked? And what their criteria for agreeing or declining is. And it really varied in terms of, well, there were different responses. So someone like Rob McDonald, author of The Nancys and Nancy Business, said he gets asked 1 to 2 times a month for endorsements, through to Sally Hepworth, whose most recent one is The Soulmate, who gets asked 2 to 3 times a week for endorsements. Established authors were kind of like once a month, up to 40 times a year, and they noted at different times that it often increases around Christmas time or in the lead up to big publishing times or when they have a new book out. Ashley Kalajian-Blunt, whose new novel Dark Mode came out earlier this year, noticed a really massive influx in requests immediately after publication of her book. And then the criteria varied, or people pointed out different things. So Rob commented that he's thinking about his readers and readership, and if he is, you know, that the book has to be close to what he writes, because if it's a recommendation from him, he wants the readers to trust that, yeah, this is in line with the kind of thing that I write. One of the established authors who wanted to remain anonymous said that for them it changed over time, so that they have tried blanket bans, you know, like just I'm not puffing anymore, to only voluntary, to only very close friends, which I thought was really interesting because I very deliberately didn't ask people who I would see as close friends. Like I didn't ask you, I didn't ask Penny, I didn't ask, you know, Vic Cannon. I didn't ask people who are my friends as opposed to kind of writerly acquaintances.
Tell you just a minor comment. The advent of lots and lots of puffs, you assume, I think, when you're asked that you're one of very few. So I think when you see books that have lots and lots of puffs, there's something in the cumulative impact of that ask, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is really important. And someone commented on this, a different established author said, you know, be satisfied with less. Don't have so many. So for instance, in the Hummingbird Effect, you know, there's two pages of praise on the inside. There's different praise on the back. There's praise on the front. You know, that's a lot. I didn't need that much. And you ask because you assume people are going to say no. So again, it's really complicated, you know.
Yeah,
do you ask one person and then they say no, and then you kind of rush to ask another, because I think people all commented on timelines being very important. Like when you ask, you've got to give enough you know, time in advance, say this is when it's due, this is when it would need to be read, this is how you're going to get the copy. So I think that's really important. And then, yes, people commented that it's really frustrating when you've gone out of your way to do this endorsement and then you're kind of on the third page.
There's 50 of you.
And there's 50 people. So I think that that's really interesting. And people commented that, and this is why people are kind of talking about it and frustrated, because publicity departments are asking for more and more puffs for these two pages of advance praise on the inside kind of thing. Mm. And partly that's because there is less space for reviews anymore. Mm. Like the review pages are shrinking. So it's one way that publishers are trying to do it. You know, they're trying to sell your book. So complicated. Sally Hepworth,
I do think there is something very credible about review copy on books. That definitely does feel like a very objective endorsement.
Yeah. And different authors that I talked to all responded that they would prefer even review copy of previous books to having to ask for praise.
That's what they did for the competition. They had.
Sally Hepworth commented that her priority now when she gets all of these requests is for debut writers, because she remembers the kind of generosity of other writers early in her career and really appreciates that you need a hand in kind of breaking through. Tegan Bennett Daylight had an interesting comment that she is again in the position of kind of increasingly saying no to all books, except those that she's had some hand in the development of, so that she might have done a read for or mentoring or teaching, and so those are her priority. And then everyone spoke to this idea of author friends and supporting the work of author friends, but and also to favors, which could be both to friends or people who'd supported you in the past, or sometimes to publisher requests as well, so that you know your publisher might ask you to endorse another book that they are also publishing.
It is kind of a bank, isn't it? Like, I think you must put so many hours of work into if you look at your Instagram feed, how many books a year would you endorse via Instagram? It would be 50 easily, surely.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and that's, you know, that like to be kind of really transparent and awkward, that's one of the things, like people will see that the people who've endorsed the Hummingbird Effect are people that I've interviewed. You know, the internationals like Sarah Centilles and Sarah Winman, who've provided really beautiful, generous quotes, you know, I've interviewed or I've worked with through their things. So, you know, you can see it's an ecosystem. One of the writers said it's an ecosystem that, you know, it's favors, it's give and take, it's the way that it all kind of works together. And we know that. Writers know it. It's why no writers that I spoke to said that they really paid attention to any praise. Unanimously, people said, no, they don't pay attention. The writers I spoke to said they don't pay attention to blurbs because they're aware of how it works. And I was thinking about this and I was like, oh, yeah, no, I suppose I don't pay attention to blurbs. And then I went, no, that's not true. I do. And there's two ways in which I do it. I do it the same way that I would read acknowledgements. So, you know, because I'm
interested. I love acknowledgements. I would read a book of just acknowledgements.
Yeah, because you're curious about, okay, well, who's this person friends with? How does this work? I think on internationals or books that I don't know anything about the writer, you know, I would go, okay, yeah, well, you know, Carmen Maria Machado said this is good and I like Carmen Maria Machado's writing, so I will read this book. So I think that's a way that, you know, I use it as a filter. And then I thought, actually, sometimes if it's a big name, and my best example of this is that I definitely only picked up Chris Lynn's Mammoth because it was blurbed by Liz Gilbert, that absolutely did work, you know.
And do you know now how he got that blurb?
Yes, because he knew Liz because his publicist was also the publicist for Liz when she came out here, and they had, you know, hung out together. So, you know, it was kind of a genuine friendship. But what people said too is that they, like you've just noted, that they take more notice of media, you know, and reviews than they do other things. People also commented that they get annoyed when they see really great praise by an author that they admire, and then they read the book and the book is meh. And interestingly, on Instagram, Melanie Dewson.
I get that. I can understand that.
Yeah, right. So Mel Dewson's got a new book out this year, I think, with Ultimo, like Fire-Hearted Sons. And Mel made the comment that she reckons more and more that endorsements are a disservice to the book, because they can damage trust in the blurbing author. This is what she was kind of saying. And she would just like to see the name of an author who endorses the book without any praise. And her comment was kind of like, let it just be that, you know, this author thinks this book is good, because if you tell me that this book is going to change my life, or it's magnificent or sublime or whatever, then I can only be disappointed. And I think, I think that's really, you know, I was aware, I know that on the Motherfault, JP Pomare had said what they ended up putting on the cover was this comparison to Margaret Atwood. And I'm pretty sure that in one of the reviews, not that it is stamped, you know, internally in my soul, that someone said, well, that's a pretty hard setup, you know. Thank you, JP.
It's very,
I loved it.
Yeah,
but,
I know. You know. I know for the helpline they had hilarious or something like that, that was just like, oh, that's pretty hard to live up to. But I will admit, unpopular opinion.
Yeah.
Goodreads is good for breadth of opinion. And if I'm looking at, I buy a lot of books on Kindle, Kobo, but if I'm looking at a book and not sure whether I want to buy it, I'll log on to Goodreads and look at 3-star reviews specifically for the
book. Okay, hang on. Just break that down. You only look at the 3-star reviews.
Yeah, because.
Why is this?
4 and 5, they loved it. 1 and 2, they hated it. 3-star is like a more interesting analysis because they can both see the good and the bad. So, you know, if you want to get the truth of what people think, it's in the 3 stars.
Okay, so it doesn't matter how many people, how many 3-star reviews there are. It doesn't matter how many top and bottom ones.
I'd directly go
there.
I'm mostly interested in the 3-star reviews.
Yep. Do you have particular reviewers that you go to that you trust?
No.
How many of these 3-star reviews do you read per book before you make your decision?
I'll read a few, like if I'm sitting on the fence, and then I reckon you read it and you can see the threads of the 3 stars.
Catherine Collette, did you look at your own 3-star reviews for?
Oh, there's one that's seared into my living memory. But that's. I do think Goodreads has a place because much as a writer, I don't want to go anywhere near it. As a reader, I find it helpful because it's without these layers of obligation and
that's interesting.
Friendship and all of those sorts of things.
Very.
But this is Goodreads, though. It is a website for readers. It is not a website for writers looking for constructive criticism of their work.
No, do not look at one's own. Look at others. Okay, so people gave some advice on how they ask, if they're asking, or how they like to be asked for endorsements. So this is a kind of a summary of the advice. Some said that they always prefer that requests go through a publisher, and this is because it's less personal than when you're being asked to say no, or if you say to your publisher, no, you do all the requests. You don't even know who said yes and who said no, so you can just stay out of it. So I thought that was interesting because I think, like, anecdotally, what I'm kind of, the conversations I'm having with people is that more and more authors are being asked to do this work themselves and to lean on their, you know, networks. Also for me, I'm kind of a bit different to that. I'm more likely to say yes to personal requests, but maybe this is just because I'm a people pleaser. You know, so for me, a personal request works, and I did make all of those requests myself because there were specific personal reasons why I asked each person, because I kind of wanted to write. You know, I needed a historical fiction writer and I needed a spec fic writer, and you know, I kind of that was important. Alice Robinson said that she realized people don't mind being asked. You know, that. You know, for her, and I think this is the same for lots of people, it's quite lovely to be asked, whether or not you say yes or no. And everyone kind of said, don't take no's personally, that there are myriad reasons other than the unpaid labor, health people referenced, you know, time, life commitments. So that one of the key things is that when an author says, no, I can't endorse your book, to really not take that personally.
Yes. I think the nicest thing to be asked on that idea of it's nice to be asked is to do a launch.
Yes.
That is the most lovely thing to be asked.
Yeah, that is true. That is really lovely. Rob McDonald said he is polite, short, to the point, really aware from the beginning of the constraints on the author's time, makes it clear what the timeline is, the understanding that it's a favour and absolutely can be declined. So I thought that was important. The established authors seemed to be moving towards requesting to publishers that there not be any endorsements on their cover, but they also acknowledged the privilege of being in that position because they were so established, so they no longer need those endorsements. And then kind of what we talked about before, don't ask for too many. And that's where I said it's, you know, it's difficult on both sides because you don't know who's going to come back in with them. So
yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's kind of complicated. So yeah, that was some of the advice on how to ask as well, which I thought was really interesting.
Oh, so complicated.
So complicated. But another complicating factor that came in, and this was a question I ended up asking people because Kate Kennedy mentioned it as a question she had, was whether blurbing was gendered. And people said, you know, had different responses, some of them being like, of course it's gendered because society is, you know, the patriarchy. But, you know, this comment that mostly you see blurbs by women, was this because it's easier to ask women? A couple of the men that I talked to had really significantly not been asked for as many blurbs as the women get asked for. So that was kind of a complicated, some people wanted to see the data on that, said, oh, that would be interesting to ask and to see whether men don't get asked because there's just less of them in the industry or because they're more likely to say no. Or
wasn't there an author who someone had approached, a big name author, and the author said, sure, I'll puff your book, just send me what you want.
Yeah.
It to
heaps,
say.
Heaps of responses, like, not heaps of responses. Yes. There were responses where people said, oh, yeah, for big names, they just say, yeah, well, I'll put my name to it. So you say what you want. You know, people make funny jokes about this. Established author who said, oh, yeah, I've just got 10, you know, throw a dart in the wall and that's the one that I'll say.
What?
And then I was actually talking about this.
That's kind of harsh, though, at the same time. Like, that's sort of the non-yes, isn't it? Like, it's sort of dismissive and agreeable at the same time.
It's like, yeah, use my name, but I'm not going to read your book.
But I won't deign to actually read your work.
From like an author perspective, what would you prefer? Do you prefer the big name on your cover because of what potentially that might do for sales? Or do you actually want this author that you deeply admire to send you a private note and say, I read your book and bloody loved it and this is why I loved it? And then
yes, what if that was the option? You either got personalized feedback that you were not allowed to share.
Yeah.
Or
right?
You got just impersonal whatever that you could widely.
Yeah, which I think is another one of those things. Like when you do have this is what you said about the performative nature of it. When you do get that feedback, do you share it? Because you know, I don't know. That's another complicated one.
Did a tree fall in the woods if no?
Right? Exactly. The kind of takeaway advice from some people in the end was to always acknowledge the support. So to send thank you notes, you know, to make sure that you thank people for it. Again, not take no's personally. One established writer who didn't want to be named said, you know, the rules for them are be kind, be generous, be supportive, be satisfied with less, and always try to see it from the other person's point of view. Hilariously, on another topic that has been on everyone's minds recently, on the topic of artificial intelligence, when I was asking Penny Russin, she put in a request to ChatGPT to, you know, provide a non-cliché blurb saying that this book will change the world. And it just did. Here are some non-cliched ways to say, you know, this book will change the world. It was hilarious. Like, and whether this question of, well, now we don't need to do it anyway. So maybe kind of AI will do this for us. So that was pretty funny. And then I also asked this kind of tongue-in-cheek question to say, well, should we just have a massive amnesty on blurbs and endorsements. And everyone kind of just immediately said, yes, absolutely, we should do that. But then, you know, then it's impossible. When do you call it?
Okay, let's do that, but just not for my book.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because that's the ecosystem. This is the kind of symbolic capital you've built up. Well, I've been doing it for 10 years and now I've got a new book coming out and I need someone to pump it.
Well, it's just such a hard space to begin with. So you feel like any tiny little thing that might create some degree of edge, it would be remiss not to pursue that.
Exactly. And I think that that is the point in the end of this idea that, okay, we're all frustrated by the labor of it, by what seems like the kind of inauthenticity of it, that we don't really trust them. But we also appreciate that we are in an industry where the bottom line is you got to sell your book. And so if a marketing department says, well, this is what you need, that you kind of do what you're told, because you are also, you know, your book does well and then the publicist keeps their job. You know, the publishing house, well, they have the money. You want to be able to keep writing, and you also know that, you know, your book does well, or a book does well in the industry, and then that, you know, supports
other books.
But let's
just say, like, if you were going to ask like a great author for 8 hours of their time, you probably wouldn't put it into reading your book. You'd probably ask them for like half the time of, I don't know, conversational. You ask them questions or whatever.
Right?
It isn't the most efficient use of someone's
time. No, it's not. And I think that what, you know, like I said, this was kind of hard for me to go into all of these responses right at this minute.
You're in the middle of it. It's fine. There's issue.
But it is, because at the same time I was like, oh, shit, I'm really now deeply aware of wading into what I've just asked. But I think what I learned from the responses too was, okay, well, here's maybe a new way that I will go forward with it, which is to make really clear criteria for myself at the start of a year of what I have space to do. So one of the established authors kind of had a thing, you know, I'll do one debut, I'll do one diverse, I'll do, you know, these are the books that I'm likely to puff. You know, I'll say that I'm going to do 5 or 10 or whatever for the year.
But even that is interesting, because you create that criteria. It's not like you then read 50 debut novels and say, this is the pick.
No, exactly.
You say, you know, you agree this, to read
yeah,
one.
Yeah, this person got in first, exactly. But I do also think, okay, well, maybe now, you know, like this is my third novel coming out. I've had this very generous praise for it. Maybe now I do set myself my own thing to say to my publisher, okay, well, for the next book, I hope no one from SNS is listening to this. But okay, for the next book, I will be more hardcore, like some of these established writers have been, say, no, I'm not going to ask for praise. You can use praise from the previous books. I'm not going to kind of engage or be an asker anymore.
Well, I think also it's an internal thing of, am I giving more than I'm taking? In this scenario. And I think you can actually hand on heart say you are giving more than you're taking in that world.
I don't know if we've answered anything for everyone. I'm so grateful to all the authors who responded, and also to the people who gave feedback on Instagram, which was also like, I just take recommendations from my mum was a really funny one, or, you know, I just trust this person and whatever they say, I will read.
There are people like that in your life.
Absolutely. Definitely. Absolutely. So that was gratifying too, to see that, okay, yeah, well, the work that we do in all the different ways that people do kind of pay attention to that. But I'd love to hear what other writers who listen to the podcast or readers who listen to the podcast have their experiences in asking, you know, the best praise that they've got, whether they have. I'd love to know if people are sitting on personal gold that they have decided for whatever reason they did not use. They were big enough to say, you know, I got an email from whichever writer I
hope
admire,
it's in
and
a,
I didn't
like
use
a compliments
it.
Folder. If yes. that is the case,
who was doing the who said about
I
the
don't
compliments
know where
folder?
That came from.
Anyway, the featured book, which I did read and I did love, that we are talking about today, which is from Amy Taylor, and it's called Search History. Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Allen & Unwin, and I'm delighted to be talking to Amy Taylor about her debut novel, Search History. Amy is based in Narm, Melbourne, An adapted chapter of her debut novel was selected as a winner in the 2021 Ultimo Prize for Best Emerging Writers in Australia Under 30. Search History is her first novel. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Amy.
Hi, Kate. I'm so excited to be here.
Huge congratulations on Search History. I absolutely tore through it, I think, variously laughing but also wincing as I was reading it. I'm fairly sure that that was the intention. To begin with, can you give us your pitch for Search History?
Yeah. So Search History follows Anna. She's a 28-year-old woman, and we join her as she's just fled from Perth to Melbourne in the wake of a breakup. And there she meets Evan, who sort of represents the opposite of every other guy that she's ever dated, and she's really intrigued by him. She makes a pledge to not look him up on social media, which goes against, you know, the current day of how we treat social media. But then the temptation is a little too much, and she discovers through his accounts that his previous girlfriend passed away a year ago, and he hasn't mentioned her, doesn't talk about her, which leaves Anna trawling through these dormant social media accounts trying to get an idea of who this previous partner was and why he won't talk about her.
Amy, where and how and when did this novel begin for you?
Back in 2017 was when I first started playing around with the idea of it. And the original idea for the plotline kind of came from my own experiences with the really strange, complex modern experience of being able to visit the social media accounts of someone who's passed away. And then from there, the plot sort of fell into place before the characters did. And then I went on a journey of trying to figure out who would be the best characters to tell this story through. And I decided pretty early on that I didn't actually want to write a book about grief, in the sense that I didn't want the main character to be sort of tied up with dealing with grief. So I needed her to be detached from it all. And that's how the idea of taking that step back and having Anna be the character that's analysing everything that's going on without having to deal with having lost someone herself. So,
I've actually used the tagline for your book as an example in a course that I run for writers about doing publicity, because it's so great. And it also helps people understand, I think, what comp or comparison titles are. So yours is Rebecca Meets Fleabag in a Sharp and Funny Debut Novel About Dating in the Internet Age. And I wanted to ask, were these your kind of comparisons while you were writing, or was this one of those amazing taglines that's cooked up by the very clever people in publicity?
So the Rebecca piece I offered up to the publishers very, very early on. And that's because I actually went through an experience of discovering Rebecca when I was already years into writing my own book. And at that point in time, I had this sort of very naive idea that I'd maybe stumbled across an idea that was quite unique as far as the plot goes. Yeah. And then I discovered Rebecca, and Rebecca has never gone out of print. It's this monumental success of a bestseller, adapted for the screen and stage 15 times. I could go on. that was a real, I had very complicated feelings about that. And obviously now I know that no idea is unique and everything's been done before, and it's the sort of the voice and the character that brings uniqueness to the storyline. But at the time I found that really disheartening, and then I read Rebecca and fell in love with it and had the most amazing experience reading a novel that I felt so emotionally invested and attached to, because it was grappling with a lot of the same themes that I had been writing about. It was almost spooky to read that, given that it was, I think, 60 years old, or however old Rebecca is. The Fleabag thing, that came from the editors, and I was a little bit mortified by that, actually, because one, how can you compare a book to a TV show? Because that's, you're always going to lose, I think. The way that people feel about Fleabag is so strong, And it is such a hilarious TV show, but no, I don't think if you're going to say a book is as funny as Fleabag that it ever will be, because it's too hard for a book to be that funny. So I love Fleabag, and I was a little bit scared, to be honest, about that comparison. But I also viewed it from the perspective that as a debut author, you only have a very quick window of opportunity for a stranger to connect with your book in a bookstore. And you've got to kind of shoot your shot. You've got to take advantage of that. And if someone else finds it comparable to that, and they think it should be used as a tagline, then yeah, I was going to go for it. Yeah.
That's great. And that is such good advice, because I know from so many of the debut writers that we speak to that they're like, oh, I can't use that person because they're too big or they're too amazing, or, you know, I can't compare myself to them. Because I actually wanted to ask you more on that. Your book and you as a writer are being compared to Diana Reid and Sally Rooney. Are these kinds of comparisons exciting, intimidating? Were they your inspirations while you were writing, or do you draw from different kinds of ones?
My inspiration, I think I was more inspired by authors like Laurie Moore, but also, and Rachel Cusk, but also more their early work. And so you can never have a tagline that says, you know, inspired by
the early work.
Yeah. Of someone who's doing something very different now, but a long time ago, they kind of wrote something similar. Yeah. So, those comparisons are always going to be really contemporary, and I do admire a lot of the authors that they bring up, like Sally Rooney and Diana Reid. So I'm happy with those. And again, they serve a purpose of, again, connecting two strangers, your book and a reader, and trying to form a really quick bond of interest between the reader and the book in a bookstore. So I'm happy with that.
One of the things that is so compulsive about reading this book is that at whatever stage I imagine readers are at, anyone with an internet connection has had that experience of going down a you know, rabbit hole of looking somebody up, you know, whether it be an ex or a rival or an ex's ex. What to you does define this kind of experience of dating in the digital age or in the internet age? And what about that did you really want to shed light on in the novel?
Yeah, I think that social media has allowed us to find out more information quicker than ever before. And I'm fascinated by the consequences of that, in and how we see that play out in all sorts of different relationships, actually. Mm-hmm. Just the ability that we can be our own detectives and do background research on anyone, pretty much, and how that changes how we present ourselves, how that forms, it can cause us to form assumptions and then change our behaviours in the hopes of controlling situations. And those are all just inherent desires that we've always had all along, but social media just allows us to do it so efficiently and so broadly. And yes, I think that is what, that side of dating, modern dating, is what really inspired that rabbit hole sort of obsession that Anna falls into.
There was also some specifics that like blew my brain, because I am not of the generation who had to date, or well, not as yet, who had to date in the internet age. So I wanted to ask, is there really such a thing as a nudes receivable album that you have come across in your time speaking to other people? Because that was great.
Yeah. No. So I'm going to say no. I've not come across that exact sort of idea, but a lot of those different behaviours, elements of those, I have witnessed and seen in either my own life or other people's lives. And I think that I'd probably say that about a lot of those sorts of ideas in the book. A lot of it's exaggerated, almost to the point of trying to make it satirical a little bit. But at its core, those are sort of behaviours that a lot of people do partake in. Yeah.
moving, you know, sideways from that, and no doubt you've been asked as a debut author with a first person protagonist of the same gender and a similar age, which parts of the novel are autobiographical? And I'm not going to ask that question, but I know that you get it. And I know that so many debut writers are worried about that question and how to answer it. So I want to come at it kind of sideways. In how do you deal with that question and talking about what is from your life or your friends' lives when you get it, if you have any favorite responses, and whether you as a reader enjoy knowing what part of a novel comes from an author's life, or if you prefer to keep them separate?
Yeah, there are tiny little elements, almost like Easter eggs, you know, in a game, that come from my real life, but only the people that they're about know that. And I like doing that because it's like leaving a little gift for your friends when they read the book, or my partner. The rest is, they're more broad experiences. And I know that a lot of people do want to know, is this based on real life? Do you know someone who's been through this? Or is this character based on someone? And they're more just genres of people rather than based on specific people I know. And I, when I do get asked that question, especially around Anna, is Anna based on me? I often answer it in a way that sort of explains that Anna was constructed as a character with specific traits, because she had to be for the plot line. There had to be a specific person that would go to the lengths that Anna goes to in the book, and that is not me. Not at all. So, it was more about, rather than trying to base the character on a real-life person that I knew or real-life experiences, it was more pure in the sense that I was actually trying to construct a character who would logically make sense in the book.
That's a lovely phrase, genres of people. It's a really nice way to use it. Amy, tell us a little bit about your path to publication, something that all of our listeners are always so interested in. It's mentioned in your bio that an early chapter of, I'm not sure whether it was this novel or another novel, was the winner of the Ultimo Prize. What was your process from that moment to getting this book published?
So the short story that I had published was the first chapter of Search History, but was adapted to be second person perspective.
Okay.
And I would say my journey has been a combination of strategy and random luck. there's a lot of advice that circulates around how to get published. There's a lot of negativity on the internet as well. So trying to avoid all the doom and gloom of people saying, you'll never get published, it's way too hard, forget about it. I took the approach of working on Search History with the aim of learning how to write a book. And so enjoying the process of figuring it out. I think there came points where I could have put it to the side and just said it wasn't working, but I stuck with it specifically because I had the aim of carrying it all the way through to the end and learning everything that I could learn from each stage. So third draft, for example, when you learn something new, I wanted to learn everything. And then submitting the short story was where the strategy came in, because when I was asked to provide a bio, I decided to include a sentence that said, this short story is adapted from a novel she is currently working on. That anthology then landed on the desk of my now agent, Benjamin Paz at Curtis Brown, and he read that and reached out to me and asked about the novel that I'd mentioned. So there's a little bit of magic there, but there is some strategy too.
I love that. So Amy, then tell us, so you had this kind of full draft. What kinds of processes, editorial, did you go through then? Did you have the stage where you wanted to throw the whole thing in the bin, or were you still committed to going ahead?
I think I knew that that stage would come at some point, because I'd heard that that is a part of it where I think sometimes the first draft can be this really fun, adventurous experience of writing a story, and then when you're forced to revisit it and figure out what is and isn't working, it can be really disheartening, and that's when a lot of people just decide that it isn't working.
What were the best parts of the process in the editorial experience then for you, either working with your agent or with the publisher that eventually picked up the book?
The first experience that I look back on really, really fondly was actually working with a mentor. Through Kill Your Darlings, I signed up for their mentorship program and I was paired with Emily Bitto. I got to spend about 6 months with her reading chunks of my manuscript, and then we would go and sit in a cafe and she would discuss it with me. And it was so generous of her as well, just to spend so much time discussing the work with me. And she's so insightful. And that experience of sharing it with someone else who didn't objectively have to say nice things about it, and could really dig into themes and threads of themes and say, you know, you haven't carried this the whole way through, you could do that better, was just such a giant leap of learning for me. And I went away from that experience with so much information about how to make the manuscript better. So that was a really exciting, and that was my first collaborative experience as well. So then when I actually went into the publishing process and I was working with editors, I'd had that experience of learning to take constructive criticism and then feeling, you know, what sits right and what maybe I don't agree with, without feeling that need to kind of please everyone and accept all feedback from every angle that it's coming from.
That's just such a great way to go into it, because I think for lots of people that first time experience is about saying, oh yes, of course, I'll make all the changes, and that you do need some practice in learning to say, no, I'm going to keep that wacky word or that idea or that character doing that. That's terrific. And of course, Emily Bitto would be an incredible mentor to work with as well. You mentioned before we started recording that you are already working on your next novel, and the advice that you'd got about getting started on that before your book came out. Can you tell us just a little bit about that process and how you're fitting your writing in around publication and all the crazy kind of feels that happen at this time?
Yeah. I can't even remember where that advice came from, and I wish I could, because I've referred to it a lot recently. But I remember reading that starting a second book before your first book comes out is a good idea, because it can allow you to dilute your attention, and then you feel like the stakes aren't as high for the first book, because it can be really hard when all these opinions are starting to get thrown at you. And as a debut author, you don't necessarily have a very clear image of your own self. And so when people start to share their opinion, it can be a little bit disorientating. And so having a second book allows you to have a little bit of an escape, I think. At least I'm finding it like a giant escape, where I can just kind of go back and just sit alone at my computer with just me and my words and just remember what that was like and get excited about new characters and a new plot. And if someone doesn't like my debut book, I can kind of be like, oh, well. You know, I'm working on this second book now anyway, it's fine. So,
have you found any part at the stage that you're at, have you found any part of it easier or harder, the actual novel writing process, or does it just feel exactly the same as the first time did?
It's feeling easier, but I do wonder whether I'm in some sort of optimistic early stage, because I can recall through how many times when I was writing my debut that I thought, oh yeah, I'm close to being done now, this is about as far as I can take it, and then a year later, you know, after revising it 10 more times, thinking, I can't believe I thought that was so close to being finished, it really wasn't. And I think it's sort of a bit like childbirth, I guess. Like they say that mothers forget the pain of having a child, and that's part of the reason why you feel okay with doing it again, because if you could viscerally remember it, you might not.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that. You have that cushion of optimism the whole way through, but now that I'm aware that that's happening, I'm sort of questioning whether I should be as optimistic as I am. But
good
I just,
question. Just go with it.
It feels more linear this time. I feel like I have a better understanding of plot, and I'm more closed off to influence of other voices as well. As a debut, you are kind of trying to find your own voice And sometimes other people's voices can kind of leave an imprint on yours. And then you read back a few chapters and you realize you've kind of gone in a different direction. Mm. This time I feel like I'm better able to ignore the voices of other authors. Yeah.
You've been in the flurry of kind of publicity as your books come out. What have been the highlights so far for you as your book has come out into the world?
I got to go on to Triple J, which was pretty cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah, that was a little unexpected, actually. So that was really exciting. Having a review come out in The Guardian was on my bucket list, my debut bucket list. And I was quite relieved when that came out as well. And then having all my family visit from Perth for my book launch was really special, and having all my friends in the room on that evening, although I hardly remember it because it was just an adrenaline blur. I can't remember a thing I said. But yeah, I can still remember that it was nice to have everyone there. And I have lots of photos that I can look back on.
Perfect. It is definitely a night to remember. Amy, before I let you go, can you share some writing advice with our listeners, maybe something that helped you along the path to writing this book?
Yeah, I was very resistant to the advice of forming a routine for a long time because I thought maybe I would become too dependent on a very specific set of circumstances. But at some point, and I think it was probably through COVID, I formed a really, really strong writing routine, and I figured out when I write best. And that's sort of in the morning straight after coffee for me. And ever since I figured that out, the quantity and quality of my writing improved a lot. And so I'm going to give the really boring advice of just figure out when you write the best and just try to replicate those circumstances as often as you can.
Excellent. And can you recommend for us a debut book, any time, any genre?
Yeah, I'm going to recommend Laurie Moore's debut, Self-Help, which was a collection of short stories. I'm just really inspired by her as an author because she has this incredible way of lulling you into a false sense of security because you're laughing and you're enjoying the story, and then suddenly she just hits you with something that rings so heartbreakingly true that it can kind of almost take your breath away a little bit. And I think that she has inspired me a lot about being earnest in my writing, which is something, especially as a millennial female author, it's not always encouraged, and a lot of people choose to write really cold, disaffected characters, but Laurie Moore kind of showed me that, yeah, being earnest is still okay.
Well, Amy, your search history certainly gives you the feels of the laughing and then kind of a gut punch of reality and realness and truth. So congratulations on your debut book and good luck with the writing of your second. And thank you so much for joining us on the First Time Podcast.
Thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.